Part 1. Deep Practice. Chapter 1. The Sweet Spot. You will become clever through your mistakes. German proverb. Chicken wire Harvards. In December 2006, I began visiting tiny places that produce Everest-size amounts of talent. The word talent can be vague and loaded with slippery overtones about potential, particularly when it comes to young people. Research shows that being a prodigy is an unreliable indicator of long-term success. In the interest of clarity, we'll define talent in its strictest sense, the possession of repeatable skills that don't depend on physical size. Sorry, jockeys and NFL linemen. My journey began at a ramshackle tennis court in Moscow. And over the next 14 months, it took me to a soccer field in Sao Paulo, Brazil, a vocal studio in Dallas, Texas, an inner-city school in San Jose, California, a rundown music academy in New York's Adirondacks, a baseball-mad island in the Caribbean, and a handful of other places so small, humble, and titanically accomplished that a friend dubbed them the Chicken Wire Harvards. Undertaking the journey presented me with a few challenges, the first of which was to explain it to my wife and four young kids in as logical, read unhairbrained, a way as possible. So I decided to frame it as a great expedition, sort of like those undertaken by 19th century naturalists. I made straight-faced comparisons between my trip and Charles Darwin's voyage aboard the Beagle. I sagely expounded how small, isolated places magnify larger patterns and forces, sort of like Petri dishes. These explanations seemed to work, at least for a moment. "Daddy's going on a treasure hunt," I overheard my 10-year-old daughter Katie patiently explain to her younger sisters. "You know, like at a birthday party." A treasure hunt, a birthday. Actually, that wasn't too far off. The 9 hotbeds I visited shared almost nothing except the happy unlikeliness of their existence. Each was a statistical impossibility. A mouse that had not only roared, but that had somehow come to rule the forest. But how? The first clue arrived in the form of an unexpected pattern. When I started visiting talent hotbeds, I expected to be dazzled. I expected to witness world-class speed, power, and grace. Those expectations were met and exceeded about half the time. For that half of the time, being in a talent hotbed felt like standing amid a herd of running deer. Everything moved faster and more fluently than in everyday life. You haven't had your ego truly tested until an 8-year-old takes pity on you on the tennis court. But that was only half of the time. During the other half, I witnessed something very different. Moments of slow, fitful struggle, rather like what I'd seen on the Clarissa video. It was as if the herd of deer suddenly encountered a hillside coated with ice. They slammed to a halt. They stopped, looked, and thought carefully before taking each step. Making progress became a matter of small failures, a rhythmic pattern of botches, as well as something else, a shared facial expression. Their taut, intense squint caused them to take on, I know this sounds weird, an unaccountable resemblance to Clint Eastwood. Meet Brunio. He's 11 years old, working on a new soccer move on a concrete playground in Sao Paulo, Brazil. He moves slowly, feeling the ball roll beneath the sole of his cheap sneaker. He is trying to learn the elástico, a ball-handling manoeuvre in which he nudges the ball with the outside of his foot, then quickly swings his foot around the ball to flick it the opposite direction with his instep. Done properly, the move gives the viewer the impression that the player has the ball on a rubber band. The first time we watch Brunio try the move, he fails, then stops and thinks. He does it again, more slowly, and fails again. The ball squirts away. He stops and thinks again. He does it even more slowly, breaking the move down to its component parts. This, this, and that. His face is taut. His eyes are so focused, they look like they're somewhere else. Then, something clicks. he starts nailing the move. Meet Jenny. She's 24 years old, and she's in a cramped Dallas vocal studio working on the chorus of a pop song called Running Out of Time. She is trying to hit the big finish in which she turns the word time into a waterfall of notes. She tries it, screws up, stops and thinks, then sings it again at a much slower speed. Each time she misses a note, she stops and returns to the beginning or to the spot where she missed. Jenny sings and stops, sings and stops. Then all of a sudden, she gets it. The pieces snap into place. The sixth time through, Jenny sings the measure perfectly. When we see people practice effectively, we usually describe it with words like willpower or concentration or focus. But those words don't quite fit because they don't capture the ice-climbing particularity of the event. The people inside the talent hotbeds are engaged in an activity that seems, on the face of it, strange and surprising. They are seeking out the slippery hills. Like Clarissa, they are purposely operating at the edges of their ability, so they will screw up. And somehow, screwing up is making them better. How? Trying to describe the collective talent of Brazilian soccer players is like trying to describe the law of gravity. You can measure it. The 5 World Cup victories, the 900 or so young talents signed each year by professional European clubs. Or you can name it. The procession of transcendent stars like Pelé, Zico, Socrates, Romario, Ronaldo, Juninho, Robinho, Ronaldinho, Kaká and others who have deservedly worn the crown of world's best player. But in the end, you can't capture the power of Brazilian talent in numbers and names. It has to be felt. Every day, soccer fans around the world witness the quintessential scene. A group of enemy players surround a Brazilian, leaving him no options, no space, no hope. Then there's a dance-like blur of motion, a feint, a flick, a burst of speed, and suddenly the Brazilian player is in the clear, moving away from his now tangled opponents with the casual aplomb of a person stepping off a crowded bus. Each day, Brazil accomplishes something extremely difficult and unlikely. In a game at which the entire world is feverishly competing, it continues to produce an unusually high percentage of the most skilled players. The conventional way to explain this kind of concentrated talent is to attribute it to a combination of genes and environment, aka nature and nurture. In this way of thinking, Brazil is great because it possesses a unique confluence of factors, a friendly climate, a deep passion for soccer, and a genetically diverse population of 190 million, 40% of whom are desperately poor and long to escape through the beautiful game. Add up all the factors and voila, you have the ideal factory for soccer greatness. But there's a slight problem with this explanation. Brazil wasn't always a great producer of soccer players. In the 1940s and 1950s, with its trifecta of climate, passion and poverty already firmly in place, the ideal factory produced unspectacular results. Never winning a World Cup, failing to defeat then-world power Hungary in 4 tries, showing few of the dazzling improvisational skills for which it would later become known. It wasn't until 1958 that the Brazil the world now recognises truly arrived, in the form of a brilliant team featuring 17-year-old Pelé at the World Cup in Sweden. Soccer historians trace the moment to the opening 3 minutes of Brazil's 1958 World Cup semi-final victory against the heavily favoured Soviet Union. The Soviets, who were regarded as the pinnacle of modern technique, were overrun by the ball-handling skills of Pelé, Garrincha and Vava. As commentator Luis Mendes said, "The scientific systems of the Soviet Union died a death right there. They put the first man in space, but they couldn't mark Garrincha." If sometime during the next decade Brazil should shockingly lose its lofty place in the sport, as Hungary so shockingly did, then the Brazil is unique argument leaves us with no conceivable response except to shrug and celebrate the new champion, which undoubtedly will also possess a set of characteristics all its own. So how does Brazil produce so many great players? The surprising answer is that Brazil produces great players because, since the 1950s, Brazilian players have trained in a particular way, with a particular tool that improves ball handling skill faster than anywhere else in the world. Like a nation of Clarissas, they have found a way to increase their learning velocity, and like her, they are barely aware of it. I call this kind of training deep practice, and as we'll see, it applies to more than soccer. The best way to understand the concept of deep practice is to do it. Ask someone to draw up two lists of 10 pairs of related words: ocean, breeze, leaf, tree, and so on. They should place the first list in a column under the letter A. The second column, under the letter B, could begin with, for example, bread, butter, music, lyrics, and so on. However, ask whoever is drawing up the list to leave out one letter from each word of each pair, replacing it with a hyphen or underlining mark. Take a few seconds to look at the lists, spending the same amount of time on each one. When you have done so, place the list face down and try to remember as many of the word pairs as you can. From which column do you think you'll recall the most words? If you're like most people, it won't even be close. You will remember more of the words in column B, the ones that contained fragments. Studies show you'll remember three times as many. It's as if, in those few seconds, your memory skills suddenly sharpened. If this had been a test, your column B score would have been 300% higher. Your IQ did not increase while you looked at column B. You didn't feel different. You weren't touched by genius. Sorry. But when you encountered the words with blank spaces, something both imperceptible and profound happened. You stopped. You stumbled ever so briefly, then figured it out. You experienced a microsecond of struggle, and that microsecond made all the difference. You didn't practice harder when you looked at column B. You practiced deeper. Another example. Let's say you're at a party and you're struggling to remember someone's name. If someone else gives you that name, the odds of your forgetting it again are high. But if you manage to retrieve the name on your own, to fire the signal yourself, as opposed to passively receiving the information, you'll engrave it into your memory. Not because that name is somehow more important or because your memory improved, but simply because you practiced deeper. Or let's say you're on an aeroplane, and for the umpteenth time in your life you watch the cabin steward give that clear, concise, one-minute demonstration of how to put on a life vest. Slip the vest over your head, the instructions say, and fasten the two black straps to the front of the vest. Inflate the vest by pulling down on the red tabs. An hour into the flight, the plane lurches and the captain's urgent voice comes on the intercom telling passengers to put on their life vests. How quickly could you do it? How do those black straps wrap around? What do the red tabs do again? Here's an alternative scenario. Same airplane flight, but this time, instead of observing yet another life jacket demonstration, you try on the life vest. You pull the yellow plastic over your head and you fiddle with the tabs and the straps. An hour later, the plane lurches and the captain's voice comes over the intercom. How much faster would you be? Deep practice is built on a paradox, struggling in certain targeted ways. Operating at the edges of your ability, where you make mistakes, makes you smarter. Or, to put it a slightly different way, experiences where you're forced to slow down, make errors, and correct them, as you would if you were walking up an ice-covered hill, slipping and stumbling as you go, end up making you swift and graceful without your realizing it. We think of effortless performance as desirable, but it's really a terrible way to learn, said Robert Bjork, the man who developed the above examples. Bjork, the chair of psychology at UCLA, has spent most of his life delving into questions of memory and learning. He's a cheerful polymath, equally adept at discussing curves of memory decay or how NBA star Shaquille O'Neal, who is notoriously terrible at shooting free throws, should practice them from odd distances, 14 feet and 16 feet instead of the standard 15 feet. Bjork's diagnosis: Shaq needs to develop the ability to modulate his motor programs. Until then, he'll keep being awful. Things that appear to be obstacles turn out to be desirable in the long haul, Bjork said. One real encounter, even for a few seconds, is far more useful than several hundred observations. Bjork cites an experiment by psychologist Henry Roediger at Washington University of St. Louis, where students were divided into two groups to study a natural history text. Group A studied the paper for four sessions. Group B studied only once, but was tested three times. A week later, both groups were tested, and Group B scored 50% higher than Group A. They'd studied one-fourth as much, yet learned far more. Catherine Fritz, one of Bjork's students, said she applied these ideas to her schoolwork and raised her GPA by a full point while studying half as much. The reason, Bjork explained, resides in the way our brains are built. We tend to think of our memory as a tape recorder, but that's wrong, he said. It's a living structure, a scaffold of nearly infinite size. The more we generate impulses, encountering and overcoming difficulties, the more scaffolding we build. The more scaffolding we build, the faster we learn. When you're practicing deeply, the world's usual rules are suspended. You use time more efficiently. Your small efforts produce big, lasting results. You have positioned yourself at a place of leverage where you can capture failure and turn it into skill. The trick is to choose a goal just beyond your present abilities, to target the struggle. Thrashing blindly doesn't help. Reaching does. It's all about finding the sweet spot, Bjork said. There's an optimal gap between what you know and what you're trying to do. When you find that sweet spot, learning takes off. Good advertising operates by the same principles of deep practice, increasing learning by placing viewers in the sweet spot at the edge of their capabilities. This is why many successful ads involve some degree of cognitive work, such as the whiskey ad that featured the tagline, "Ingle L's, Ingle L's." The holidays aren't the same without J and B. Deep practice is a strange concept for two reasons. The first reason is that it cuts against our intuition about talent. Our intuition tells us that practice relates to talent in the same way that a whetstone relates to a knife. It's vital, but useless without a solid blade of so-called natural ability. Deep practice raises an intriguing possibility, that practice might be the way to forge the blade itself. The second reason deep practice is a strange concept is that it takes events that we normally strive to avoid, namely mistakes, and turns them into skills. To understand how deep practice works, then, it's first useful to consider the unexpected but crucial importance of errors to the learning process. In fact, let's consider an extreme example, which arrives in the form of a question. How do you get good at something when making a mistake has a decent chance of killing you? Edwin Link's unusual device. In the winter of 1934, President Franklin Roosevelt had a problem. Pilots in the U.S. Army Air Corps, by all accounts the military's most skilled combat-ready airmen, were dying in crashes. On February the 23rd, a pilot drowned when he landed off the New Jersey coast. Another was killed when his plane cartwheeled into a Texas ditch. On March the 9th, four more pilots died when their planes crashed in Florida, Ohio, and Wyoming. The carnage was not caused by a war. The pilots were simply trying to fly through winter storms, delivering the U.S. mail. The crashes could be traced to a corporate scandal. A recent Senate investigation had exposed a multi-million dollar price-fixing scheme among the commercial airlines contracted to carry the U.S. mail. President Roosevelt had swiftly responded by cancelling the contracts. To take over mail delivery, the president called upon the Air Corps, whose generals were eager to demonstrate their pilots' willingness and bravery. They also wanted to show Roosevelt that the Air Corps deserved the status of a full military branch equal to the Army and Navy. Those generals were mostly right about Air Corps pilots. They were willing, and they were brave. But in the harsh winter storms of 1934, Air Corps pilots kept crashing. Early on the morning of March the 10th, after the 9th pilot died in 20 days, FDR summoned General Benjamin Foulois, commander of the Air Corps, to the White House. "General," the president said fiercely, "when are these airmail killings going to stop?" It was a good question, one that Roosevelt might have directed at the whole enterprise of pilot training. Early pilot training was built on the bedrock belief that good pilots are born, not made. Most programs followed an identical procedure. The instructor would take the prospective student up in the plane and execute a series of loops and rolls. If the student did not get sick, he was deemed to have the capability to become a pilot, and after several weeks of ground school was gradually allowed to handle the controls. Trainees learned by taxiing or penguin hopping in stubby-winged crafts, or they flew and hoped. Lucky Lindy's nickname was well-earned. The system didn't work too well. Early fatality rates at some Army aviation schools approached 25%. In 1912, 8 of the 14 US Army pilots died in crashes. By 1934, techniques and technology had been refined, but training remained primitive. The airmail fiasco, as Roosevelt's problem swiftly became known, raised the question pointedly. Was there a better way to learn to fly? The answer came from an unlikely source. Edwin Albert Link, Jr., the son of a piano and organ maker from Binghamton, New York, who grew up working at his father's factory. Skinny, beak-nosed, and epically stubborn, Link was a tinkerer by nature. When he was 16, he fell in love with flying and took a $50 lesson from Sidney Chaplin, half-brother of the movie star. "For the better part of that hour, we did loops and spins and buzzed everything in sight," Link later recalled. "Thank heaven I didn't get sick, but when we got down, I hadn't touched the controls at all. I thought, that's a hell of a way to teach someone to fly." Link's fascination grew. He started hanging around local barnstormers, cadging lessons. Link's father didn't appreciate his interest in flying. He briefly fired young Edwin from his job at the organ factory when he found out about it. But Link kept at it, eventually purchasing a 4-seat Cessna. All the while, his tinkerer's mind kept circling the notion of improving pilot training. In 1927, 7 years after his initial lesson with Chaplin, Link went to work. Borrowing bellows and pneumatic pumps from the organ factory, he built a device that compressed the key elements of a plane into a space slightly roomier than a bathtub. It featured stubby prehensile wings, a tiny tail, an instrument panel, and an electric motor that made the device roll, pitch, and yaw in response to the pilot controls. A small light on the nose lit up when the pilot made an error. Link christened it the Link Aviation Trainer and put up an advertisement. He would teach regular flying and instrument flying, that is, the ability to fly blind through fog and storms while relying on gauges alone. He would teach pilots to fly in half the time of regular training and at a fraction of the cost. To say that the world overlooked Link's trainer wouldn't be accurate. The truth was the world looked at it and issued a resounding and conclusive no. No one he approached seemed interested in Link's device. Not the military academies, not private flying schools, not even barnstormers. After all, how could you learn to fly in a child's toy? No less an authority than the US Patent Office declared Link's trainer a novel, profitable amusement device. And so it seemed destined to become. While Link sold 50 trainers to amusement parks and penny arcades, only 2 reached actual training facilities. One he sold to a Navy airfield at Pensacola, Florida, and another he loaned to the New Jersey National Guard unit in Newark. By the early 1930s, Link was reduced to hauling one of his trainers on a flatbed truck to county fairgrounds, charging 25 cents a ride. When the airmail fiasco hit in the winter of 1934, however, a group of Air Corps brass grew desperate. Casey Jones, a veteran pilot who had trained many of the Army pilots, recalled Link's trainer and persuaded a group of Air Corps officers to take a second look. In early March, Link was summoned to fly from his home in Cortland, New York, to Newark to demonstrate the trainer he'd loaned to the National Guard. The appointed day was cloudy with zero visibility, nasty winds and driving rain. The Air Corps commanders, by now familiar with the possible outcomes of such hazards, surmised that no pilot, no matter how brave or skilled, could possibly fly in such weather. They were just leaving the field when they heard a telltale drone overhead in the clouds, steadily descending. Link's plane appeared as a ghost, materializing only a few feet above the runway, kissed down with a perfect landing, and taxied up to the surprised generals. The skinny fellow did not look like Lindbergh, but he flew like him, and on instruments, no less. Link proceeded to demonstrate his trainer, and in one of the first recorded instances of nerd power trumping military tradition, the officers understood its potential. The generals ordered the first shipment of Link trainers. 7 years later, World War II began, and with it the need to transform thousands of unskilled youths into pilots as quickly and safely as possible. That need was answered by 10,000 Link trainers. By the end of the war, 500,000 airmen had logged millions of hours in what they fondly called the Blue Box. The military's regard for the efficacy of Link's trainers apparently went only so far. Link was permitted to sell hundreds of his devices to Japan, Germany, and the USSR in the years leading up to World War II, creating a situation where both sides in many dogfights were, training-wise, evenly matched. In 1947, the Air Corps became the US Air Force, and Link went on to build simulators for jets, bombers, and the lunar module for the Apollo mission. Edwin Link's trainer worked so well for the same reason you scored 300% better on Bjork's blank letter test. Link's trainer permitted pilots to practice more deeply, to stop, struggle, make errors, and learn from them. During a few hours in a Link trainer, a pilot could take off and land a dozen times on instruments. He could dive, stall, and recover, spending hours inhabiting the sweet spot at the edge of his capabilities in ways he could never risk in an actual plane. The Air Corps pilots who trained in Links were no braver or smarter than the ones who crashed. They simply had the opportunity to practice more deeply. This idea of deep practice makes perfect sense in training for dangerous jobs like those of fighter pilots and astronauts. It gets interesting, however, when we apply it to other kinds of skills, like, for instance, those of Brazil's soccer players. Brazil's secret weapon. Like many sports fans around the world, soccer coach Simon Clifford was fascinated by the supernatural skills of Brazilian soccer players. Unlike most fans, however, he decided to go to Brazil to see if he could find out how they developed those skills. This was an unusually ambitious initiative on Clifford's part, considering that he had gained all his coaching experience at a Catholic elementary school in the soccer non-hotbed of Leeds, England. Then again, Clifford is not what you'd call usual. He's tall and dashingly handsome and radiates the sort of charismatic, bulletproof confidence one usually associates with missionaries and emperors. In his early 20s, Clifford was severely injured in a freak soccer accident, suffering internal organ damage, kidney removal, and perhaps as a result he approaches each day with immoderate zeal. In the summer of 1997, when he was 26, Clifford borrowed $8,000 from his teachers' union and set out for Brazil, toting a backpack, a video camera, and a notebook full of phone numbers he'd cajoled from a Brazilian player he'd met. Once there, Clifford spent most of his time exploring the thronging expanse of São Paulo, sleeping in roach-infested dormitories by night, scribbling notes by day. He saw many things he'd expected to find. The passion, the tradition, the highly organized training centers, the long practice sessions. Teenage players at Brazilian soccer academies log 20 hours per week compared with 5 hours per week for their British counterparts. He saw the towering poverty of the favelas and the desperation in the players' eyes. But Clifford also saw something he didn't expect. A strange game. It resembled soccer, if soccer were played inside a phone booth and dosed with amphetamines. The ball was half the size, but weighed twice as much. It hardly bounced at all. The players trained not on a vast expanse of grass field, but on basketball court-sized patches of concrete, wooden floor, and dirt. Each side, instead of having 11 players, had 5 or 6. In its rhythm and blinding speed, the game resembled basketball or hockey more than soccer. It consisted of an intricate series of quick, controlled passes and non-stop end-to-end action. The game was called Futebol de Salão, Portuguese for soccer in the room. Its modern incarnation was called Futsal. It was clear to me that this was where Brazilian skills were born, Clifford said. It was like finding the missing link. Futsal had been invented in 1930 as a rainy day training option by a Uruguayan coach. Brazilians quickly seized upon it and codified the first rules in 1936. Since then, the game had spread like a virus, especially in Brazil's crowded cities, and it quickly came to occupy a unique place in Brazilian sporting culture. Other nations played futsal, but Brazil became uniquely obsessed with it, in part because the game could be played anywhere. No small advantage in a nation where grass fields are rare. Futsal grew to command the passions of Brazilian kids in the same way that pickup basketball commands the passions of inner-city American kids. Brazil dominates the sport's organized version, winning 35 of 38 international competitions, according to Vicente Figueiredo, author of History of Futebol de Salão. But that number only suggests the time, effort and energy that Brazil pours into this strange homemade game. As Alex Belos, author of Futebol, Soccer the Brazilian Way, wrote, Futsal is regarded as the incubator of the Brazilian soul. The incubation is reflected in players' biographies. From Pelé onward, virtually every great Brazilian player played futsal as a kid, first in the neighbourhood, and later at Brazil's soccer academies, where from ages 7 to around 12, they typically devoted 3 days a week to futsal. A top Brazilian player spends thousands of hours at the game. The great Juninho, for instance, said he never kicked a full-size ball on grass until he was 14. Until he was 12, Robinho spent half his training time playing futsal. Like a vintner identifying a lovely strain of grape, a cognoscenti like Dr. Emilio Miranda, professor of soccer at the University of São Paulo, can identify the futsal wiring within the famous Brazilian soccer tricks. That elastico move that Ronaldinho popularized, drawing the ball in and out like a yo-yo, it originated in futsal. The toe-poke goal that Ronaldo scored in the 2002 World Cup. Again, futsal. Moves like the despero, el barret, and vaselina. All came from futsal. When I told Miranda that I'd imagined Brazilians built skills by playing soccer on the beach, he laughed. Journalists fly here, go to the beach, they take pictures and write stories. But great players don't come from the beach. They come from the futsal court. One reason lies in the math. Futsal players touch the ball far more often than soccer players, 6 times more often per minute, according to a Liverpool University study. The smaller, heavier ball demands and rewards more precise handling. As coaches point out, you can't get out of a tight spot simply by booting the ball downfield. Sharp passing is paramount. The game is all about looking for angles and spaces and working quick combinations with other players. Ball control and vision are crucial, so that when futsal players play the full-size game, they feel as if they have acres of free space in which to operate. When I watched professional outdoor games in São Paulo, sitting with Dr. Miranda, he would point out players who had played futsal. He could tell by the way they held the ball. They didn't care how close their opponent came. As Dr. Miranda summed up, no time plus no space equals better skills. Futsal is our national laboratory of improvisation. In other words, Brazilian soccer is different from the rest of the world because Brazil employs the sporting equivalent of a link trainer. Futsal compresses soccer's essential skills into a small box. It places players inside the deep practice zone, making and correcting errors, constantly generating solutions to vivid problems. Players touching the ball 600% more often learn far faster without realizing it than they would in the vast, bouncy expanse of the outdoor game, where, at least in my mind, players run along to the soundtrack of Clarissa tootling away on the Blue Danube. To be clear, futsal is not the only reason Brazilian soccer is great. The other factors so often cited, climate, passion and poverty, really do matter. But futsal is the lever through which those other factors transfer their force. When Simon Clifford saw futsal, he got excited. He returned home, quit his teaching job, and founded the International Confederation of Futebol de Salão in a spare room in his house, developing a soccer program for elementary and high school age kids that he called the Brazilian Soccer School. He constructed an elaborate series of drills based on futsal moves. His players, who mostly hailed from a rough, impoverished area of Leeds, started imitating the Zicos and Ronaldinhos. To create the proper ambience, Clifford played samba music on a boombox. Let's step back a moment and take an objective look at what Clifford was doing. He was running an experiment to see whether Brazil's million-footed talent factory could be grafted to an utterly foreign land via this small, silly game. He was betting that the act of playing futsal would cause some glowing kernel of Brazilian magic to take root in sooty, chilly Leeds. When the citizens of Leeds heard of Clifford's plan, they were mildly entertained. When they actually witnessed his school in action, they were in grave danger of laughing themselves to death at the spectacle. Dozens of pale, pink-cheeked, thick-necked Yorkshire kids kicking around small, too heavy balls, learning fancy tricks to the tune of samba music. It was a laugh. Except for one detail. Clifford was right. 4 years later, Clifford's team of under-14s defeated the Scottish national team of the same age. It went on to beat the Irish national team as well. One of his Leeds kids, a defender named Micah Richards, now plays for the English national team. Clifford's Brazilian soccer school has expanded to a dozen countries around the world. More stars, Clifford says, are on the way.